I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Who wants to hire people with master's degrees in administration when today's business culture demands managers who can master the process of innovation? That's the question Business Week asked in a recent profile of Patrick Whitney, director of the Institute of Design at IIT, the nation's largest school of design. He is our guest today on Smart City, and we'll find out why cities may be the next design frontier. We'll also talk with Libby Sartain, who, along with Mark Schumann, is co-author of Brand from the Inside, published by Josie Bass. She is Senior Vice President of Human Resources and Chief People Yahoo, and former Vice President of the People Department at Southwest Airlines. We'll talk about how design and smart people management add value to organizations today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Patrick Whitney is the director of the Illinois Institute of Technology's Institute of Design, the largest graduate school of design in the U.S. Last month, he was labeled a design visionary by Business Week, who is out to bridge the chasm between the cultures of business and design. Patrick has published and lectured throughout the world about how to make technological innovations more humane, the link between design and business strategy, and methods of designing interactive communications and products. Patrick, why has design suddenly become such a hot topic?
I think the reason that design is getting so much attention in the last 5 or 10 years is that companies have finally realized that there's been a power shift from producers to consumers. You know, at the beginning of the last century, Henry Ford could get away with saying, give them any color they want as long as it's black. Now the power phrase comes from the anonymous customer who wants what they want, when they want it, at the price they want, through the distribution channel they want. This is driven by customers having more choice, being able to get things from anywhere. And for companies to be able to compete in this environment, they have to pay more attention to customers' deep-seated, unarticulated desires, and design is the way to do that.
Clearly, we have arrived at a moment where design is definitely in ascendancy. Why this particular moment? It seems to be culminating now with this real focus.
I think because we have just come out of a 4 or 5 year period where companies have been focusing on cost cutting as a way to improve the bottom line. And in this competitive environment, because of the big trends that we just talked about a minute ago, paying much more attention to what customers really need, even before they can describe what they need, is the way to do that.
Well, and how do you discern needs before customers can articulate them?
One major way is through watching what people do rather than paying so much attention to what they say they want.
Give me an example, a real-world example of that method at work.
I think many people are familiar with a very low-tech product called OXO Good Grips. OXO Good Grips is the brand name of a set of kitchen gadgets, potato peelers, can openers, knives, things like that. These are the ones that have the large black rubber handles that are much more comfortable to hold and look better than the 79% vernacular potato peeler that has remained unchanged for decades. What the team at OXO did when they were doing the front-end observation was go into people's homes and looked at how they manipulated things in their homes and how they held things. And what they would find is there were a large number of people who found it unusually difficult to open the pull tab on a can of Coke or to open the bottles of from their pharmacy, the pill bottles. The design and development team at OXO noticed that people were doing all of these things to make it easier to hold things.
Now, I know those are the kinds of methodologies you teach at the Institute of Design, where you are director. Tell me about the Institute of Design. Tell me what you teach there. The method you just described is not one most people would associate with design.
It's true. Most people think of design schools as art schools, where the main thing you learn is drawing and model making and how to choose the right colors. Instead, what we are focusing on is getting deeper understanding of users and linking the insight about users to business planning so that companies can create products and messages and services that serve people's needs better. So rather than our introductory courses being about drawing and model making and choosing color, students learn about how to observe users in their daily life. Students learn about why innovation is becoming so important to businesses now.
Your comments were focused on business planning and business innovation, but I know that there's much work at ID that's actually focused on the public realm or what would be generally considered public problems. If I came to you, Patrick, with a challenge and I said, I'm a mayor and I need to get more of my citizens riding public transit, how would you tackle that kind of challenge?
The way we would start that is by looking at people's current experiences in taking public transit, and not just from when they get on the train or the bus to when they get off, but the whole day in the life of a person's getting around town. We've done projects like this in Chicago, and it turns out that people start making their transit decisions shortly after they get up in the morning, when they're wondering, do I take the bus, do I take the L, do I take the train, do I drive today? And they have to make a bet on what is going to be the most efficient and reliable way to get to work. And they are making that bet with incomplete information. The transportation experience also involves other things. It involves dropping off videos from the night before. On the night home, it involves picking up cleaning. From the user's point of view, it would help a lot if these things were integrated. So, for example, does it make sense at major L stops to have drop boxes for Blockbuster Video? Does it make sense for convenience stores to be located in transit stations with high incidence of use? Looking at it from the user's point of view, all of these things get integrated. From the producer's point of view, you know, from the CTA's point of view in Chicago, they probably don't think a lot about dropping off videos. But the user does when they're making a choice about what they have to do to get to work and get home at night.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Patrick Whitney. He is director of the IIT Institute of Design in Chicago, the largest graduate school of design in the U.S. Patrick, you were named one of the four Western thought leaders on Sina.com's list of the top 25 people advancing international Chinese business. Very impressive. What role is design playing now in China's growth? We typically think of China as the place that you do the cheap manufacturing, but design seems to be taking much more of a central role now in China's economic growth plans.
Yes, you're right. And the reason for that is there's two ways to look at China. One is it still is a source of inexpensive manufacturing for certain categories of products, but it's also becoming a market for products and services. There is a growing middle class in China, particularly in the eastern cities, but moving into the west as well. And they are buying things, and they don't want to just buy cheap versions of what has been sold in the west. They want things that are particularly relevant to daily life in China. For example, Lenovo is a Chinese computer manufacturer. They're the company that just bought IBM's PC division. Lenovo has looked at how people live their lives in Chinese households, and they've noticed that even though a household might have one or two kids in it, and mom and dad, and a couple of grandparents, they will tend to only have one computer. Now, think of the problem of four or five people using one computer in terms of file management. You know, how do you get to the information that's relevant to you? Well, Lenovo put a large knob on the top of the keyboard that you can click through. And as you move from one position in the knob to click through to another position, it turns the computer into your computer or grandma's computer.
Oh, what a great idea. Yeah. And China now has design in its new economic plan, design very centrally.
Every 5 years, there's a new economic plan that the government produces. The most recent one just came out in November. It's their 11th five-year plan. And they're very concerned with the growth of design and innovation and the growth of creative industries.
Now, you have a very large percentage of your students at the Institute of Design who are not from the U.S.
About 40%.
And what perspective do they bring that U.S. students don't?
One of the things that they will almost all bring is, in general, a broad perspective on the world and a big, big focus on export markets, because developing countries focus on exports as the first driver of what they develop. The context in other countries for design is quite different, particularly in Korea, where design is one of the superstar industries that have helped the transformation of Korean society and Korean industry in the last 15 years. People will remember when Samsung and LG were not brands. They were unknown companies that were suppliers to specifiers of that were original brand companies that were coming from Europe or the United States. And Samsung and LG and SK and other sophisticated companies in Korea have absolutely used design to transform themselves into brand leaders and to creating innovative products that are leaders in their category across the world.
I know that you and the students at ID have been very involved in developing products and strategies for what's known as bottom of the pyramid. C.K. Mm-hmm. Prahalad coined that term in his book, Bottom of the Pyramid, looking at products and services that can be provided profitably to people with very low incomes in developing countries. Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of that work.
Well, what's driving it, which has been pointed out by C.K., as you say, is that companies, large multinational companies, normally have two ways to grow. One is through mergers and acquisitions, which we know don't work most of the time, and the other is through bets on new technology, which are also risky. What Professor Prahalad is saying is there's a third way to grow, and that is to pay attention to the other 4.5 billion people in the world that large companies tend to ignore now because we don't think they have enough money. So the central idea is that these large companies, and these are leaders in it, have been Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and Unilever, but many companies are doing it now, are looking at the particular needs of not the middle-class people in India and China and Brazil and Russia, but people in the lower income who spend a lot of money, but very cautiously and very carefully and need offerings to be tailored for their particular needs. So, for example, in the slums of India, rather than selling a supersized 64-ounce bottle of shampoo that lasts a long time because their houses are so small and because they don't have money to buy 64 ounces of shampoo at one time, selling a single-use sachet in a small package that is biodegradable makes much more sense for single-use purchases. The general premise is that because these markets are so challenging, it forces companies to be so innovative to serve them that they can bring those innovative learnings back into their home markets and compete more successfully here as well.
You mentioned biodegradable packaging. What role is sustainability playing now at ID?
An increasing role. We have courses in that look at the whole life cycle of products and look at the green issues side of sustainability. There are really three dimensions of sustainability. One is the green issue and environmental sustainability. One is social sustainability. Does the product offering or the service offering help promote a healthy society? And the third one, of course, is economic sustainability. Companies need to make money at it or they're not going to keep doing it. So our students are taught to look at things in a systemic way from all angles and think about the environmental issues and the social issues and the economic issues simultaneously.
You are sending so many students to companies all over the world, mm-hmm. and I know you just have a crowd of companies trying to recruit students from the Institute. Where are they putting design in their companies? Where does design fit?
Well, traditionally it's gone into the design department, but because of this broader look at the world of innovation that we and some other schools are taking, the graduates are going into all parts of the company. So we've had people hired straight out of our design school to be senior directors of strategy at McDonald's. We've had people in charge of user research at Motorola. We have people in charge of hardware development at Microsoft. These are people who don't have design in their title, in their job title, but are using design thinking and processes that help them make systemic innovation changes and understand users throughout the whole company, whether it's marketing or organizational management or strategy or design.
When you use the term, Patrick, design thinking, describe what you mean.
It's a term that is becoming more general, and I think it's best to compare it to a normal management way of thinking where you look at how things are now. You look at your current competition. You look at your current production capability in your current market. And you look at apparent opportunities, and you pick one, and then you drive towards it as an efficient and fast and optimal way as possible. What's happening in the business world is things are changing so quickly that, in general, executives are trying to create not the one right answer and drive towards it, but move forward with several options, postpone making the decision that they eventually will need to make, and then as they notice how the world is changing from this series of options, make the decision and go with it. Design thinking is not about optimization. It's about exploring alternatives. It's about prototyping ideas early, not just prototyping physical concepts, but prototyping what an organization or what a service might be, and doing that extremely early in the process so that you can learn from watching people use the prototype. It's about moving out of a world that is totally reliant upon verbal descriptions and spreadsheets, and adding to that visualizing systems and visualizing products and services that make it easier for development teams to get a more concrete view of what the innovation might be, more concrete than what is normally able to be understood if you're only using spreadsheets and written descriptions of what the innovation could be.
We talked about one example with transit, but tell me how you think design thinking and design methods can be used to make cities better places for people to live.
I think there are several ways. Certainly in the realm of physical spaces, you see it very important to attracting people who want to live in cities. Take Chicago, where if you go back 50 or 100 years, one of the main reasons for people to want to move here is because there were factories in the town and you wanted to be close to your factory job. And there were so many now what seem like small-scale factories that were close to residential areas and the factory workers could walk to work. Now, in the information age, where factories are more likely to be in China or Taiwan and Chicago's economy is more involved with service industries, people in service industries, often you don't have to be as close to your workplace, and sometimes you don't even have a workplace. The issue is, how does a city attract people to live in it? And so you look at things like Millennium Park, I suppose, is one of the great examples of the world of not just creating a place where you can see interesting art, but creating a phenomenal magnet that helps attract people who want to live in the city. So that happens in the physical realm. Outside of that, design can be used to help transform the schools. If Henry Ford came back and visited most public schools in this country, he would recognize the processes, batch processing, things done by schedule, a command and control experience. I think the public schools are one of the last institutions to not have responded to the way the new world works. If you look at companies or even governments are much more responsive to the disruptive digital technology and other forces that are changing the way organizations work. It's very interesting to think of what would happen if the only thing you kept in public schools was formal learning goals, that you knew that you wanted kids to learn things, but you left open to question whether we still want classrooms where people sit in them for an hour at a time, where you still have long summer vacations when you and semester systems that are fixed? What if you opened up these other parts of what constitutes a public school to really focus just on the learning goals and not worry about the other things? It's a big change, but the world is going through big changes in design. We're actually doing projects now that relate directly to this issue and transformation of schools.
If you didn't have the job of running the Institute of Design and money and time were no objects, which design challenge would you like to tackle?
I think in this country, there are two that are very exciting opportunities and would help fix many of the country's problems. One is healthcare, and the other is public education system. So we've talked a little bit about the public education system. Let's talk about healthcare. Every time a new hospital gets built in a community in this country, almost always it has fewer beds than the one it replaces. That's because healthcare is moving to the home. And the products and services that have traditionally been designed for the healthcare system have been designed for professionals to use, doctors and nurses or medical technicians who have 2 years of education. These same monitoring devices, et cetera, are now being put on the dresser in a person's bedroom when they get let out of the hospital, sometimes far earlier than they think they should be let out. And a medical technician frequently comes in and gives instructions on how to use it. Now, the medical technician has spent 2 years learning how to use equipment like that, has learned nothing about how to educate people how to use it, and spends about a minute telling the person how to use it. And the person isn't sure whether it's for measuring their blood pressure or measuring their calorie intake. You know, it's completely confusing. We've probably done 50 projects looking at the use of medical equipment and medical information in people's homes. We've been looking at the chaos that goes on during a shift change at a nursing station. The interesting thing is how much information gets contained or conveyed by handwritten notes written on Post-it notes and attached to books, or how a patient's file has a particular place it's supposed to be kept, but it's also needed in several other places on the floor. And frequently people are looking for people's medical charts and can't find them. So there's incredible opportunity in both in clinic and in the home to make a big difference for patients and medical workers.
Patrick, thanks for talking with us about design on Smart City today.
Thanks. It's been fun.
Patrick Whitney is director of the Institute of Design. When we come back, we'll talk to Libby Sartain, who has been the people specialist at two of the nation's most successful companies, Yahoo and Southwest Airlines. Plus, we'll find out from Otis White the latest news on cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, as you've pointed out, cities have turned the corner, particularly from 1990 to 2000 and on. We continue to see cities on the upswing after decades of decline. But you found a couple of professors from the University of Virginia who are reminding us that the revival of urban areas is nuanced.
It is, yes. And it's a really good reminder. The two professors at the University of Virginia are William Lucy and David Phillips. They've been studying cities and suburbs and metropolitan areas for a while. And what they found is, by and large, very good news for cities. But it is, as you say, nuanced. The most encouraging statistic about cities these days is that the central city's income is rising fairly dramatically. When you look at per capita personal income, it is significantly up from just 2000 to 2004. And this indicates that more and more affluent people are moving back to older neighborhoods and downtowns. Very good news. What they have also found is that, on the other hand, population is not necessarily increasing in these cities. And even in some cases, household income is not increasing in these cities. It's flat or maybe up just a little bit. And what can explain this? Well, people who are coming back into the cities are very different from the folks who were there in decades past. So the stockbrokers who are moving in are taking an apartment that might have housed four people, at least in the stockbroker's point of view, barely big enough for one person there. So you're having more affluent people coming in, taking greater amounts of personal space in cities, and as a result, you're not seeing a lot of population growth in these cities. Sometimes the household income, there is those four people, so let's say three or four of them of whom were working, would have made collectively more than the stockbroker. But the stockbroker on a personal income basis makes a lot more per capita. So the statistics are a little funny, but they are basically very good for cities. It's a good thing that after so many years of exporting affluent people, they're now importing affluent people. And the other part of the research that Lucy and Phillips have done, which is intriguing, is so if cities are doing relatively well, what's the growing problem area? And it is the older suburbs, the suburbs that were built between, say, 1945 and 1970. Because the houses are too small there, the way the land was subdivided is often not very interesting. The housing tends to be a little bland-looking. The average house of the 1950s, for instance, was about 1,100 square feet, which is just too small for most families today. So the great problem of those older suburbs, these two professors say, is that when families have to make a decision about where do we want to live and where do we want our kids to go to school, they're going to go out even further into the suburbs. And when young single folks, younger people, empty nesters are deciding where do they want to live, they're going to go the opposite way into the cities. And it's the person in the middle, that is the older suburbs, who's going to be ignored.
Mm-hmm. This is an area, it's interesting, a couple of years ago, maybe several years ago, I remember that the magazine Metropolitan Home began to focus on some of these ranch houses that were in the older suburbs that were about that size that designers were taking and tearing out walls and making landscaping them differently, sometimes adding to them in the back, but making them very, very cool, very livable places. But that movement seems to have died somewhere along the way. And I think you're right. The housing stock that remains in these older suburbs, again, that seems too small for our, you know, for all the things we have to have in our lives these days, is a big challenge for urban leaders.
They do have some advantages. They have proximity. They could be served by transit more easily than the older suburbs, the newer suburbs could be. So there are some possibilities for turning these places around, but it's going to take a lot of creative thought and a lot of work to keep them from going into decline.
I agree. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. Libby Sartain is co-author with Mark Schumann of Brand from the Inside, published by Josie Bass. She is Senior Vice President of Human Resources and Chief People Yahoo, and former Vice President of the People Department at Southwest Airlines. Libby, you write in your book, Brand from the Inside, that you believe in the power of employer brand. Explain what you mean by employer brand.
Well, in the book, we have defined employer brand as the way that a business builds and packages its identity, and that stems from its origins and values, and then what it promises to deliver to emotionally connect employees, so they in turn will deliver what the business promises to customers. So if you want to boil it down, it really is what a business stands for, but how you brand that to your people inside the company.
In so many companies, that is a very wide gap. Why is that?
I think what happens is you have marketing people on one side who are promoting your product or your overall company brand, and they're putting their own spin on it in terms of what they think they're going to sell. But then inside a company, the employees who create that product or produce that service, they're the ones who have to actually deliver on the promise. And because most companies operate in silos, sometimes we fail to make the connection between having the employees as the ambassadors for the brand.
How do you get them to play that role?
Well, first, they have to completely believe in and own the brand. The brand has to be part of the DNA. And so you have to collect everything that you know about yourself, your history, your legends, what you stand for, your DNA. You have to find a way to package that and make it come to life for employees. And once you do that, then they can sort of just by nature know how to deliver that to their customers.
When you say you package the DNA for employees so they get it, give me an example of how that is operationalized at companies you've worked with, which are some of the best, Yahoo and Southwest Airlines.
Sure. I'll first talk about what we did at Yahoo. When we went through a rebranding exercise and we identified our brand as Yahoo as a life engine, then we took all of the products and services that we offer to employees. And, you know, sometimes HR people don't think that we offer products and services, but we do. We have employee benefits, we have compensation programs, we have our facilities, we have our training programs, and we rebranded those under two, if you will, different kinds of brands. One was called My Life. So we have a series of My Life, My Rewards, My Life, My Benefits, My Life, My Career. And these are all the tools that help you understand what's available to you as an employee that affect your life. If you will, this is sort of the emotional connection to our brand. And then we created My Guide. And My Guide is more of the functional way to navigate your way around the company. So instead of a policy manual, which every company would have, we have something called My Guide to Working at Yahoo. And it's more or less a way to find your way around the company and what our policies are, but it's much more user-friendly. And we have My Guide to Interviewing, if you're a manager, or My Guide to Rewarding and Recognizing Employees. And so we have a series of guides for managers.
Libby, does the conversation about packaging the products and services you offer to employees as a life engine, if you will, to mirror what you, to your DNA and what you are to your customers, does that begin with marketing? Does it begin with HR? Does it begin someplace else?
Well, every company does it differently. In some cases, the marketing people really believe in this and engage the HR people and the corporate communications people. In other companies, corp communications may be the galvanizing force, and in other companies, HR needs to be the galvanizing force. There's no right or wrong answer, but the one thing that has to happen is that all of the communicators, marketers, and HR people need to be on the same page working together instead of being out there with their own separate messages. And that even involves the operators. And in a company like Yahoo, our technical people have to be consistent with how we promote our technical messages so that they're on brand as well. So every organization's different.
How do you keep that coordinated within the company?
Well, that is the hard part, I think, and there's no magic answer, but one thing is getting everybody in the room regularly and talking about what you're doing so that you don't step on each other's toes. One of the things that I've tried to do here at Yahoo is once a month meet with our head of marketing and our head of corporate communications and share all the things we're doing that could affect each other so that we're all on the same page and we're all consistent with our messaging. We're not always perfect, but that helps a lot.
You gave me excellent examples from Yahoo. Can you give me an example of the employer brand, the way in which it was built and then translated to employees at Southwest Airlines?
Yes, because this is, I discovered with a great team of people at Southwest the concept of employer branding when Southwest became a big national brand in the early 90s. So we had been sort of a small company, and one day when we realized we were flying from coast to coast, we thought it was time to come up with a national brand. So our marketing people work with our ad agency and really try to ask ourselves, what do we stand for and what makes us different than the competition? And we came up with this concept that Southwest was a symbol of freedom. And that is pretty deep. And in the past, we had had a lot of brand messaging like the low fare airline or the Southwest Spirit or the Love airline. And all that messaging was pretty easy to have employees internalize. But when you're talking about a symbol of freedom, how do you make that personal for employees? We went through a lot of efforts. It really took a couple of years. At first, marketing did a marketing campaign to employees, but that didn't make it come to life. And then we had a culture committee that did a really neat program where they sent a steamer trunk in the belly of airplane from city to city and had each city put their own symbol of freedom in the trunk. And that was a cool program. And we created a museum with all the symbols of freedom. But again, it didn't make it real to employees. And so we sat around one day and said, how are we going to make this so real that an employee knows what their role is in delivering the freedom? And we came up with this concept of creating an internal or an employer brand. And after much work, weeks and weeks of work, we came up with our internal brand at Southwest, Freedom Begins With Me, so that every employee understood their role as delivering that freedom. And then we repackaged everything we offered to employees under 8 freedoms. And these were things such as the freedom to learn and grow, which covered all of the training programs, the freedom to create financial security, which were the retirement plans. And there were 8 freedoms under which we marketed the employer experience. So the employees now sort of knew, whoa, I deliver the freedom, but then I get certain freedoms for working here. And that was done in the branding came about in the mid-90s, and the employer brand came about in 1999, and it's still alive because once you have it, it pretty much sticks and becomes part of your DNA.
Southwest Airlines is in many ways an anomaly in the airline industry, along with the low-cost carriers that have followed it. You say that the employer must define what's in it for me for employees to work there, but what's in it, Libby, for employees in, let's say, the airline industry where salaries are being cut, people are being laid off? I'm on a plane usually at least a couple of times a week, and employees can be, you know this, indifferent, rude, and understandably so, given their situation, but in many ways they're making a bad situation worse. How can that cycle be broken?
Well, I can't speak for every airline. I don't think that is the case at Southwest, because I fly every week too, and I still fly Southwest a lot, and I see a difference when I fly Southwest. I think that once something is broken, it's very hard to fix it. So short of a major change in the culture of that organization, it is very, very difficult. One thing that a big airline can do that is suffering through all this is to get employees involved. And I think a lot of airlines are recognizing that. There's been a lot of union representation in the airline industry, and airlines typically would try to deal with the union rather than with the heart and mind of every employee. And that's what makes a difference.
Southwest Airlines is, and Yahoo as well, are both known for giving employees a lot of room to express their personalities. Do the companies set limits on how far an employee can go, and has that flexibility ever backfired?
Well, when you have an employer brand, then that sort of becomes a language all its own, and it sort of sets the boundaries for you. So in the case of Southwest, we love to have flight attendants or customer service agents that use their own brand of humor when giving the safety announcements or when checking in the plane. And so we encourage people to be their own. And we talked about, when we did training for flight attendants or training for customer service agents, what were the boundaries? What things were off limits? You know, and obviously certain kinds of jokes or humor is not appropriate. So yes, every now and then a rare person stepped outside the bounds, and when that happened, we talked to that person and said, please don't do that again, and they generally didn't, and then they would probably tell their friends, I got in trouble for doing this, and then, you know, everybody sort of knew what the boundaries were. The same kind of thing happens at a company like Yahoo, where we do have lots of employees that express themselves in different ways, and many have their own personal blogs or websites, and you know, we have standards upon which we want the company to be represented and represent our brand, and most people sort of know that and learn that, and if somebody goes out of the boundaries, we talk to them and ask them not to do that again. So that works pretty well.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Libby Sartain, who, along with Mark Schumann, is co-author of Brand from the Inside, published by Josie Bass. How do you know, Libby, if your employer brand is healthy?
Well, you have to kind of assess that. And I think you can look at some of the normal factors like your turnover. Are you having a turnover problem? Or when you hire people, are they joining you and are they accepting your offers? Another way to do it, and this is what we did at Yahoo, we actually did a cultural health assessment where we did a survey with our employees and asked them, you know, do they think their atmosphere is healthy? And we asked a lot of questions about the brand and what we stand for. And we use those results to determine what we need to improve. In the book, we give a lot of questions that you could use or a series of tools that you could use to diagnose. But most often, if you're starting to think about we have a problem and we need to work on our employer brand, something's not working well somewhere along the way.
And if you had to characterize the typical barriers to branding from the inside, what would they be? You mentioned culture.
Yeah, actually, you know, branding from the inside is really sort of taking your culture and marketing it inside the company. But if your culture doesn't allow you to talk about your culture, that could be a barrier right there. But I think the biggest barrier is one we talked about earlier, is everybody working in their own silo and then doing their own thing and then having inconsistent messaging and inconsistent, you know, one department that has a whole different brand than another department and operates itself completely differently. And I've observed that in companies I've worked for and in other companies that I've talked to their HR people and found out what's going on. So the barriers need, the silos need to be broken for this to work effectively.
Silos is something that's a concept that's talked about a lot. So it's not as if we don't know they exist. And yet, as you say, they continue to exist. And it could be a result of turf battles. It could be a question of just lack of time to get together. It's hard to believe that it's lack of awareness that silos are bad things and we need to get out of them. So why do you think that problem continues to be a barrier?
Well, I've thought about it a lot because it's something that I think everybody that works for any organization of any size runs into. And it's a natural occurrence because when you have a small company and everybody can get around one conference table and talk about what's going on, that's pretty easy. But obviously, if your company grows and is successful, you need to have a way to divide up the work. And so most companies organize themselves in business units around certain products and then in functions around certain functional areas of expertise. Or they organize themselves around geography or some other method that you can break the company into manageable chunks. And then you have leaders over those manageable chunks. And then before you know it, the leader's own personality sort of takes over. It's just an inevitable situation. What was beautiful about a company like Southwest is we were in one business, the airline business.
Yes.
We were divided by geography. And so because we were very clear about who we were and what we stood for, and we had a history of that, and we had the same founder involved with the company from the day it started, and he's still involved now as chairman of the board, we were pretty clear on that. So as we began to grow, we began to see that, oh, we're not consistent across the country. We need to fix this. And the way we were able to fix it was by having a very comprehensive leadership program for people who ran locations that started with our values and what we stood for and how we led. and what our messaging was. But that wasn't enough. We had regular planned messaging all throughout the year where leaders and managers came together for events where they heard what was going on, where they heard the key messaging. You know, it's something that I remember some of my coworkers when I was there would say, we hear the same thing over and over again. And I'm like, yeah, but you've been here 10 years. Think of the person who just started last week. They've never heard it before. So sometimes you have to repeat yourself like a broken record.
You've had the good fortune to work for two companies and their founders. Do you think that employee branding and branding from the inside gets more difficult as the founders retire and move away from the business and the professional managers take over?
I do think that's a danger. And I remember one time when I was with Southwest, we had an executive from a company where that had happened. And he came and he said, I don't know what our culture is, and I don't know how to make our culture come alive in my company. And it turned out his father, or actually his grandfather, had started the company. So what you need to do in that situation is kind of go back and think of why were we created in the first place, and what did we stand for, and what are the things that are still important or imperative today from what those original founders started. There is a DNA there, whether you know it or not. Sometimes you just need to uncover it and find out what it is.
It's interesting you say that the employer brand extends through an employee's leaving an organization. How do you make sure that employees leave with a good feeling about the employer brand?
I think that having alumni of a company who leave with a good feeling is important, and I think it's becoming more and more important. And I think one of the type of industry that really has done this well is professional services. And if you look at things like big accounting firms or big consulting firms, a lot of those alumni go on and take senior roles in big companies and become clients. So they've learned how to keep their alumni together, keep them involved, and have them leave with a good feeling. I think that the first thing you have to do is look at how you terminate somebody or how somebody leaves you. Is there a good process in place? Whether it's mutual or whether they're leaving and it's not their choice to leave, or whether they're leaving because they got another job they like better, you want them to feel good every step of the way as they leave the company and have a chance to tell you what went well and what didn't go well, have all of their benefits and comp and all the things that have to be closed out efficiently, you know, leave with a pat on the back for what they've done for you for all those years. A departing employee can do more damage than anybody to your image as a company if you don't handle it right.
Well, Libby, I appreciate you being with us to talk about your new book, Brand from the Inside. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
You're welcome.
Libby Sartain is co-author with Mark Schumann of Brand from the Inside. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. City Views commentator Walker Smith joins us each week to give us his very personal look at life in cities.
The cover of Time magazine on April 5th was emphatic. The headline read, "Be worried. Be very worried." One of the subheads proclaimed, "Earth at the tipping point." A lone polar bear was pictured stranded on an ice floe floating in the middle of a melted polar ice cap. Al Gore's new movie, An Inconvenient Truth, preaches the same message. Global warming threatens our way of life, if not our survival. And if we hope to avert this crisis, we have to act now. So I went online last week and calculated my personal carbon footprint. That is, the annual amount of CO2 generated by my lifestyle, both at home and for business. In fact, I used four different carbon footprint calculators, there are several online, hoping to find one at least that would show me in a better light. Instead, every one came up with the same result. My lifestyle generates well over twice the CO2 tonnage of the average American. To offset that, just to be carbon neutral, I would have to plant more than 70 trees each year. I confess that I am stunned by this discovery. I've always been a bleeding heart on environmental issues. I've never thought about it much, but I always just figured my political values carried over subconsciously into my lifestyle choices. Obviously not. The irony here is not lost on me. As the old Pogo comic strip once joked, we have met the enemy, and he is us. The immensity of this issue can be overwhelming. It seems to be the problem of nation-states and global corporations, way beyond anything a single person could affect, at least until you calculate your own carbon footprint and see the disproportionate contribution to this problem that single individuals can make, which is to say, me, and maybe as well, many of you. We have fallen into lifestyles that are highly wasteful when it comes to energy, resources, and the environment. This is the one thing not at dispute in the debates over global warming. We are poor stewards of energy and resources. Whether this creates global warming or other inequities is another matter. Irrespective of consequences or implications, we live inefficient and extravagant, if not profligate, lifestyles when it comes to energy and resources. Even many of us who give money, time, and votes to environmental causes are no better, and sometimes much worse, than everyone else. Now, I don't have anywhere to plant 70 trees each year, so I will have to reduce my carbon footprint in other ways. But I want to do so as much for the discipline of living more responsibly as for reducing my environmental impact. Both are important, but responsible, economical, parsimonious living is much more than that. It is about the character and sensibility of my life. Indeed, I think this is true of our social life as well. Our collective carbon footprint reflects one aspect of the care with which we manage our affairs. Whatever else it may do, this is a discipline worth a stronger commitment. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.